Call to order this meeting of the Joint Interim Task Force of Primary and Mental Health Care Reimbursement. And as a matter of welcome, again, welcome everyone from holidays. We've enjoyed the last few minutes prior to the meeting with regaling ourselves of just some of the fun and challenges of the holidays, and hope and trust everybody has enjoyed that time and is refreshed and ready to go into that very active season. So as for introductions, I'd like to start on the phone. For anyone that's called in, could you introduce yourself?
Well, this is Robin Henderson. It's the Charles Health System in Bend.
Outstanding. Good to have you.
And you are a solo player on the phone, Robin.
At this time. At this point. So we'll go around.
Oh, I just rolled the phone all by myself.
Yeah, such power. We'll start with Dr. Smith.
Janine Smith, Chief Medical Officer, Oregon Health Authority.
Coralie Koning, Oregon Society of PA President.
Mary Grant, Oregon Nurses Association. And co-chair.
Staff. Sandy.
Rick and Kate, Peace Health co-chair.
I'm John Lively, state representative from Springfield.
Julie Parrish, state rep from Westland.
Good. Well, we welcome you all today. To as a matter of course, we are starting an informational meeting at this juncture of time. We will gavel out of that informational time into a brief work session and then back out. So just to kind of give you an idea of the flow today, and depending on the time we take in our first session and the last session, it's possible we could exit the room a little sooner than usual. So we'll just kind of see how all of that goes. So at this point, everyone on the committee has seen the final version of the task force report. It's gone through innumerable edits. We're well into double figures on drafts. but hopefully everyone has had a chance to go through the last draft in detail and make sure that it truly reflected our discussion. As of this point in time, and so I'm going to open the floor for additional comment. If necessary, we can bring about some editing functions either in this time or most likely in the work session. I would like to open it up for comment. Make sure that everybody we did get. Responses. So we didn't get a lot of editing that came from the committee. We felt seemed that most of the responses were positive. So wanted to open it up for discussion and comment.
I had a couple of technical edits that I forgot to get to Sandy. Actually, on the previous section, and I'll give them to her. It's just how the workforce committee is referred to. It's the Oregon Health Policy Board. Workforce
what
committee.
What page are you on?
Page 5.
Okay.
And I can just give you my page that has, you know, it's just that it's the workforce committee of the policy board. There are several places. I'll.
Oh, well.
So the comma, using the comma and then reference to the Oregon Health Policy Board.
But I did have some changes that are more substantive that I was going to suggest for the last recommendation on the alternative payment.
And I think we'd need that on the record.
Okay.
So if you want to go through
okay.
that.
Okay. So those were just technical, like how you refer to the workforce committee.
Got it. The okay. way I've categorized yeah. them and titled them. Okay.
The policy board had a retreat this week or so ago. And we're not totally sure at this point if the sustainable healthcare expenditures work group in number one is going to be setting a target itself or not. So I just was thinking that the language there could say they're going to continue to understand high cost drivers and cost trends and work towards.
Jane, where are you?
I said
recommendation
number one on page 7. So I had some suggested change of saying that you have utilized the policy board's shoe. They're going to be understanding the high cost drivers and cost trends. Period. and then would be working toward setting a total healthcare cost reduction. So I don't have like a timeline or a date that, and whether it's that group that sets the actual benchmark or not is still a little unclear. The policy board asked the committee to, you know, keep looking at those expenditures, and they'll consider it down the road as far as how, whether they would actually set a benchmark. So just for some clarity on that first bullet. And I can give you my scribbles.
That'd be great.
Okay. And then the only other thing was on number three. We don't know exactly how the behavioral health home will fit with the patient-centered health home. We're just going to be for context to let you know, we're starting up the patient-centered home standards committee to look at how behavioral health home elements, the reverse integration will work. But I mean, there's nothing terrible.
The language to say to study, though, it seems to me that would be.
Yeah.
We don't have
a behavioral health home designation at this point in the state. Mm-hmm. We've talked about possibly having the patient-centered home and somehow designating those that are more behavioral health focused versus those that might be more OB focused versus children focused. So there's some national stuff going on around behavioral health home and some newer approaches. So we have a learning collaborative of behavioral health clinics that are learning how to maybe meet the current patient-centered home standards. So it's kind of a work in progress. I was just, the language isn't terrible. I just was just letting you know that we don't have a behavioral health home designation process that's at this point in time. But
so are you wanting to change number three?
Well, I would have said behavioral health focused primary care, patient-centered primary care homes, but
Some
of the behavioral health folks are still wanting a distinct, separate behavioral health home designation. We just haven't come together to have that discussion yet.
Robin, would you be willing to comment on that, kind of what the current thoughts around the language should be in number three, referring to the behavioral health home?
Yeah, I was just sitting here thinking about that, and I think it's really great that the staff is going to bring up a conversation about behavioral health homes. But even before they do, there aren't really even standards around the process, around the practice of integrated behavioral health and primary care to begin with. It's not defined. It's not very clear what a regular patient-centered primary care home does, even before we get to the practice of a behavioral health home. So part of the work that we've been doing with the Integrated Behavioral Health Alliance folks is putting together a ledge concept that would define the practice of integrated behavioral health. Whether it's in a behavioral health home or not is really irrelevant, but there's not a definition and agreement on what the practice of integrated behavioral health looks like in primary care. Is that part of the work that you're seeing is going to happen there in that SAC, or is that a step that they're skipping and just going straight to the behavioral health home definition?
Well, I think the essence of the patient-centered primary care home standards were to set the desired outcomes and not dictate the approach. So if you read the standards now, there is language around integration of behavioral health, but it doesn't tell you, it doesn't proscribe how to do it. What the essence of the committee's discussions over the three versions of the patient-centered home standards committees have been, let's focus on the outcomes we want and let's not prescribe to the clinics exactly how to achieve them, and then leave it up to the payers to reward them based on their tier structure. So
a wide variability in practice, including whether or not you're utilizing licensed providers, are you able to use community health workers? So all of those other types of things that aren't really, I get the nebulousness of saying, let's set the standard of what we want the outcome to be. I believe it's too nebulous. And because it's too nebulous, that's part of what's driving payers to not pay for the service and not pay for the things that we're picking up in here that we're saying need to be done. So I think that there's opportunity for that space to be better defined. I'm hoping.
Yeah, I mean, I think in the course of whenever that we have done the standards, because when we went through with, so we did the standards, we had a representative, you know, behavioral health, PEDS, family medicine, internal medicine, consumers, et cetera, at that very first committee. We always felt that behavioral, those, it was more, trying to make it as patient-centered as possible. I know that when we went back through to look from a pediatric lens exclusively, we ended up like adding family. I mean, that was really the only difference in all the standards, is making sure that we thought more about the family with the pediatric population. So, but we didn't say exactly how a pediatric patient-centered home should function. So, but we gave examples. So here's how it would work in an adult population, here how it would work in a peds population for each of the care coordination, et cetera. So I could see what we have done in behavioral health integration is give examples of how other, or share through our technical assistance activities, approaches to achieve it. But, you know, it's up to the committee to suggest how, and we want to make sure we have good representation from the behavioral health community. So it just, we'll see how, I just don't see them coming out with prescriptive, but that, you know, doesn't preclude others from being prescriptive.
And I think to Robin's point, some of the work going on in CCOs in this state is looking at trying to get a little bit more prescriptive around the services or elements that we would consider baseline or need to have functions within an integrated behavioral health primary care environment. So I think that we're starting to inform that process, and I think to Robin's point, I think the question is what are the key services, and then recognizing, understanding those, then you can begin to quantitate the cost and thus the potential remuneration that's necessary to assure that those services are there. So I think that's kind of, you know, the intention as we go forward is really to get a little bit more clarity. And I think certainly with the primary care medical homework, that's also been part of the discussion, is to really have a little bit more definition, whether it's the tiered system that currently exists. So that's about definition and services in the different tiers. So I think kind of get a little more clear about that. That really hasn't happened necessarily with the on the behavioral health integration side yet to the degree that it's probably necessary to inform payers. Would that be fair, Robin?
I think it's very fair. And given that there are now really great guidelines that came in out of AHRQ that are very clear definitively, I think there's a lot we can learn from that space. And using that tiered approach, it's kind of like defining out what the basics are so that a payer knows what is and is not relevant. And I think to all behavioral health providers, I am one, I believe that firmly, but there's a wide practice variability between what we do in specialty mental health and what we do in the integrated primary care space, both in terms of practice, how we chart, how we document, and how we procure patients. The use of registries and other types of things like that are very important to that practice in a very different way.
And the question really before us is, does the language in bullet three, you know, reflect that? The language is to study a similar payment mechanism for patients established in behavioral health home for their primary care. Again, it's to study. I think that there is a lot of work that's going to have to happen in order to best define that, although some of the standards are becoming more clear. Is the wording adequate, at least with respect to our report to the legislature? I'm not sure we could add language that would make it, ask them to make it pretty prescriptive, but this was really to study as opposed to.
It was just the term and capitalized behavioral health home that's not defined at this junction. So
do
I don't know.
Remove
if,
it?
So I was just wondering if it would, you know, you could use for patients established in a behavioral health focused primary care setting.
Okay.
Just because we don't have a definition at this point. I mean, we have national. A variety of national definitions for that, but we'll get there, but we just aren't there yet.
Okay.
So the language is then...
Is that all right, Robin? Is that okay?
Yeah, no, I get exactly where you're going, and I agree with you. We haven't defined what a behavioral health home is for the state of Oregon. Mm-hmm.
But because right now we actually have patient-centered homes that are behavioral
homes. We don't have a definition around it. I think the issues that I'm talking about in terms of making integration, making the practice of integrated health services more pronounced in how we get at that, I think it touches on that in bullet two.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it touches on that adequately in bullet two. So I would almost pull back a little bit in bullet three.
So would it be okay, though, to use the language that Dr. Smith just gave, which was to care for patients established in a behavioral health-focused primary care setting?
Yes.
I think that's appropriate at this point, since we really don't have the same level of designation.
There are patient-centered homes that are getting paid differently that are a behavioral health clinic as we speak. Of those 500-some clinics currently certified as PCPCHs, there are several that are mental health clinics.
Right, and they're paid in a different
fashion. And they're paid and they're tracked by the CCOs and now the PEB plans as a PCPCH, so they're inspiring more of those.
So for the record, I want to read what I think you folks have discussed. Instruct the OHPB, modeling after the primary care multi-payer agreement process, to study a similar payment mechanism to care for patients established in a behavioral health focus for their primary care.
Well, what the wording she used was established in a behavioral health focused primary care setting.
Okay, so after
getting rid of home setting. For there.
In a primary care setting. Right. This is
okay.
Because if you're gonna vote on this
focused
right.
primary care setting.
Great. Thank you.
And I think that adequately, what we wanted to call out was that there may need to be, as Dr. Smith just pointed out, different payment mechanisms for patients who receive their primary care in a behavioral health setting. It is much more expensive to do that. The level of care and the acuity of the patients is typically substantially higher. Again, trying to reflect that in your payment model so that indeed those services can be provided. Does that language sound okay?
No, it makes sense to me. I knew it was how do you get back how we pay and how you identify that, so that makes sense to me.
Go calling that out. And again, there's a lot of work behind these
right.
requests of certainly the Oregon Health Policy Board. So, and they're in process of doing that. So, and Janine, do you have the language for that first one? I want to make sure we get the language reflected so that when we go into our work session, we can just.
But where do you want that put?
In here.
Okay. Then if you want to read it into the record, the whole number one.
Do you want me to read it into the record? So,
because you folks need to be clear on what verbiage you're voting on.
So the verbiage on the first one, we'll kind of hate to do a lot of on-site editing here, but we'll do that, is to interject after the word to.
Line one?
On line one.
Okay.
Line one. So utilize the Oregon Health Policy Board Sustainable Healthcare Expenditures Work Group to understand high cost drivers and cost trends.
Period.
Drivers. Working toward setting a target. So you're going to remove the word set, and after the word two, you're going to introduce understand
high cost
drivers
right.
and cost trends
period,
comma, working towards setting a target. Setting, and then that would and you're going to remove the word C. And I think that the reason for interjecting, you could say, well, is this really critical to the line item? But I think that what Dr. Smith is pointing out is the importance of truly understanding what are the cost drivers as you're looking at sustainable healthcare. What are the drivers that are affecting that? And I think that was definitely reflected in our discussion. around, you know, what was really pushing the cost of care. So I think calling that out, I think, is appropriate. So let's see if we got it.
After SHU, the acronym, two, and then we're going to insert understand high cost drivers and cost trends, comma, working for setting
towards, a, working towards.
Working towards setting
a,
target for total health care cost growth reduction, cumulative for all payers across Oregon. Thank you. Semicolon.
Yeah, it's less about setting a benchmark than it is about understanding. And that's what's really going to help inform further decisions.
Yeah. Okay. Very good. Thank you. Any other things that came from your discussion with the policy board?
Only disruptions I have.
I have been supplied also a update for the OSPA on some of the things that they would like to have some verbiage change as well.
Okay.
But this is kind of going back to the front of the back on page two. At the top under findings for fair payments. Says the report leaves out mention that PAs are also were subjected to insurance reimbursement cuts for primary care before House Bill 2902 was passed. I'm not sure. I'm sorry. I'm having a little trouble seeing a little this morning. So,
are you at the bottom of the page?
Yeah, down at the bottom of the page under findings.
Yeah. So, do you want to add NPs and PAs?
Yes.
Right. On that last
on the last line.
Full sentence on the bottom of page two.
Well, I didn't know whether you just wanted these.
Oh, I see.
Pages.
While the cuts began in mental health within a few years, several carriers also made reductions in reimbursement for NPs and PAs in primary care.
Yeah.
Sure, we missed that.
Great.
Sorry.
Yeah, something simple. And then on page three, I know we've talked about this before, but I guess we haven't quite gotten it in there yet, but the training levels for some of the PAs, it also impacts, you know, based on the proportion of pay to education costs, it's very high impact on the PAs as well. I personally have came out of PA school with about $200,000 debt. So it says that the PA bullet is significantly different and seems unfinished. And I know I've made these comments, but this is about a month ago, and I can't remember exactly what I did. So I'm going to have to look at it again, too.
I just want to try to get Tasky here a little bit. But I want to understand, so you want to reflect the cost of training. Is that correct? Is that the concern is really calling out the cost of
the
training?
The fact that we ask that it doesn't take into consideration that the cost of training for the PA also is significantly impacted.
Where are you looking?
You know what, can I look at these a little bit later and reintroduce it to myself before I bring it up to you guys again? Because I'm actually kind of having trouble following where they go now, too.
You want us to come back to it?
Yeah, let's come back to it.
Great.
Because what we're hoping to do this in this first section this morning is really get clear language so that as we move into our work session, we can go ahead and move forward. So do want to make sure that the language reflects the issues that are being dealt with by the providers. And certainly the cost of education and training is significant. Not sure where we call that out necessarily.
Yeah. I have just a couple. On page four, in the paragraph right under findings regarding support for primary care. So the sentence starts with, the workforce shortage is even more dramatic in the rural areas of Oregon, particularly for psychiatric physician access. Could we put psychiatric provider access? So it addresses that. So just slip physician out and put provider.
Right.
The second is...
Robin, okay with that?
Right, yeah.
One thing, just a second though. One thing, I think we do need to call out both, but one of the things that came out in the testimony was the lack of support actually for psychiatry, truly to having a psychiatrist in the rural environments.
Yeah.
And so I want to make sure we call that out because that is a really significant problem in the rural environments, in addition to other providers. But,
absolutely.
I think we were trying to call that out, but maybe let's think about what that language could look like.
I agree with you because I'm not particularly comfortable taking out physician at this point. It kind of waters down what the shortage piece that we were going to.
Well, you can.
And some of these things, just due to scope and statute, can't be replaced with other types of providers at this time.
Well, then let's do psychiatric physician access, physician and NP and PA access. Can we add those two? So we're not diminishing the physician, psychiatric physician access, as well as nurse practitioners and PA in psychiatric.
Well, to give a perfect example right now, we're in a position in our hospital with an acute psychiatric unit where February 1st I'm going to be down to two psychiatrists. And both in terms of scope of practice and in terms of Medicare law, I've got to have psychiatrists who do the admitting and are the medical director and all of those other types of things, and that's not something that can be be replaced or be dealt with even if we change all the best models in the world, change funding. And I am a big supporter of alternative types of providers, but that in particular, I feel more comfortable if we went for a second step. I don't want to lose that piece of it. It's impacted us, it's impacted Bay Area Hospital, and maybe what it is particularly for psychiatric physician access, if we want to add something that says in hospital service or what. I just don't want people to assume that there's I'm going to use the wrong word, but it's the only one I can come up with, that there's equality in there. Because there really isn't at that point when you're looking for students at hospital services.
Okay. Well, we don't have to add it. We can leave the sentence as is. I mean, it's not a sticky point for me, so why don't we just leave it as is, as psychiatric physician access, so that point is well taken.
But and again, I think what we were, the reason for the wording as it existed is the first sentence,
right.
Which called out that primary care and behavioral health providers of all types is significant, and then more dramatic in the rural areas, particularly for psychiatric physician access. And I think we were saying up front that we got problems everywhere, but the reality is that particularly Robin had called out tremendous problem we have in having psychiatric care.
Great.
That's required by law.
All right. So we won't change.
Are we going to leave it?
If it's okay with you,
No, we're going to leave it.
I think your intention,
yeah,
really to make sure we call out the shortage is
but
still
it
included
is,
in the
it's still in
sentence.
The paragraph. Yeah. So the second bullet point that says limited training opportunities, residency slots, MD, DO, PA. Could we put NP? Instead of RN.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
That's it. Those are my two. NP degree
thank
position.
Thank you. Sorry.
That's it.
Is that the only place that's highlighted?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm not sure why we didn't pick that one up.
Good catch. Those are your only two?
Yeah.
Corey, you got...
I'm sorry. I got it back together again.
Language.
If you go back to page three...
Okay.
I understand again now where it is. The third bullet in that last group where it kind of sets the PA across, you have the sentence for the cumulative years for medical school for the physician, the cumulative years of training for MPs. It should have that same language for PAs
as well. Right.
So what we should be saying is cumulative years of training for PAs, particularly those specializing in primary geriatrics and pediatrics. It should be the same exact thing. We shouldn't have to bring up any of the licensing or the other stuff that's not really mentioned in the other two bullets as well. So it should be uniform right there.
So you want it to read cumulative years of training for NPs
And PAs.
And PAs, particularly those specializing in behavioral health geriatrics.
Okay.
Right, you can just take out that third one and just put us up there with the NPs and PAs.
And then just totally delete the third bullet.
Yeah, that should be that's clear. And on page 4, kind of back to the idea of the debt burden, I'm not sure how exactly to put this in, but I just wanted it also to be noted that, you know, there is quite a bit of student loan debt for the PAs and MPs. We're at master's and doctorate levels, and those costs, you know, should be noted that those are actually expensive for us to come out because we're not making as much as the physicians are making as well. So the proportion of income to debt is quite great for the PA and NP as well.
So are you proposing calling out, in addition to physicians, NPs and PAs?
Yes, please.
And that's in which?
Fifth bullet on page 4.
Yeah, in the
large
middle.
Debt burden for physicians, NPs, and PAs
coming out of training.
Training.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Influencing their choice. Okay. So we're going to delete medical school, replace with training, after physicians, PAs, coming out of training, influencing their choice of residency programs for those specialties. Okay.
And Corley, would you mind just a second going back to page 3 on that third bullet point? You'd recommend deleting that bullet point?
Yeah, because
I think what the intent was to call out that the PAs in most environments work under the physician. And so that was to call out the way that the mechanism for licensure and billing is different for that population than an independent nurse practitioner.
I see what you're saying. The collaborativeness, I understand, but do you think that's necessary in this particular bill to do that? Or, I mean, does it really enhance the whole thing that we're trying to establish? I mean,
does it add information?
Add anything?
So you don't think that's necessary to call that out? That's what you're saying?
I don't think in this setting it did. You know, after we were looking at it, we were kind of thinking, you know, it's really kind of setting us as different, and we're really not different. And it really is not necessary for this bill or for this task force, I mean, to understand how the PAs are licensed or anything. We are providers, and we're licensed just as like the physicians are, and
right, but not entirely independent. So
right,
the,
we are dependent practitioners.
I mean, there is a difference.
Yeah.
So I think we're just trying to call out that there is currently in the law a difference around that. So because there is a difference.
And I'm going to want. Can you tell me exactly where you are?
We're on page three.
The last set of bullets, third bullet point. And the question was whether or not we call out that there is a difference with respect to how the licensing mechanism and the oversight and supervision function between physicians, nurse practitioners, and PAs, there is a difference. So the question is do you call that out? I think that's where Coralie's going, is it necessary to call out that difference, or do we just, that's the question to me. And I think the feeling of the PAs is it really just didn't want to call that out. Yeah, correct.
Yeah, I mean, it just seemed like it was, makes us look a little different in the situation that we really, we do carry an individual license. We do work collaboratively with our physicians, but we didn't think that was something that had to be in this particular area. I mean, do we need to call that out in the bill? I mean, in the recommendations? If you want to.
And it was just informative for the legislature. So it's just to point out, again, that there is a little difference and that the PAs are allowed to bill insurances via their NPI numbers. I don't, you know, it's not critical to me personally, but I think it was something that came out that there was a difference in the in that mechanism. But we can pull that if that's the collective wishes of the group.
Let me talk to let me just talk to my resources and let you know before the end of the day end of the session here, if that's okay. Just chat with her real quick.
Well, at this point, I think we do need to either pull it or leave it in. I mean, I think that that's kind of our choices. And if it really doesn't add value, if the feeling is that it's really not that important, then great, let's just leave it out. If it's okay to call that out, then, and I think the intention was just to call out the differences between the different types of providers. But to be honest, if it's not helpful, we can certainly omit it.
Mm-hmm. Here's my thinking in there. I think when I'm looking at the audience that's going to read this, the audience is primarily legislative. And they're not necessarily experts in how all of our licenses and scopes work. Mm-hmm. I'm inclined to leave something that helps to define that. I'm not sure I'm fully understanding why we want to pull it out, because it helps to define how that works, so there are assumptions. But maybe I'm reading that wrong?
No, I mean, it's fine. We can just leave it in.
Don't the NPs carry an individual license as well?
Right.
So,
but
right, and it's called out.
But, well, it isn't.
It isn't though.
Not.
See, that's the issue, right? So you would put...
The MPs.
You could say
the
both...
MPs are not called.
Yeah, both the PAs and the MPs carry an individual license, period.
But we're collaborating.
The PAs have to work with their supervising physicians.
Right, MPs don't have to. So.
Yeah.
And just leave it at that? Take out that last...
And they both are allowed... are MPs allowed to bill with an NPI?
Under services
via it should be
a number?
Yep.
Is it the same number, NPI number?
Mm-hmm.
So do we want to just omit then the last two sentences?
And add NPs to this?
I mean, I think we got that clear.
I don't think NPs came and said
what they did, and the
right.
PAs came and said what they did, and you're just trying to capture that in this document.
Yeah,
I think the last sentence, importance of cumulative clinical experience, doesn't belong in that particular bullet.
Right, we can pull that out.
Okay. Yeah, now you went to... I'm sorry, where did you go with the
Okay,
bullet?
So I would say both PAs and NPs carry an individual license to practice, period.
Okay.
The PAs work collaboratively with their supervising physicians, period. Both NPs and PAs are allowed to bill insurance.
Okay, hold on. Mm-hmm. Both NPs and PAs
right,
are allowed to bill insurance for services
via their...
Okay.
It should be
their
CAGIR.
Instead
via,
of...
Okay, their NPI. Got it.
And then I guess you could... Now that last sentence makes more sense.
Yeah. Importance of cumulative...
Well, there's no verb in
that. Yeah,
it's a fragment. So I don't know what we were trying to accomplish with that fragment.
Well, I think that sentence had other things in it before it got... I think we should just eliminate
that last sentence.
Let's eliminate that last sentence. Yeah. So what is the reading now? Do you have that?
I do. PAs, both PAs and NPs carry individual licenses to practice, period. They, or were we going to call out NPs, MPAs work...
No,
PAs work collaboratively with their supervising physicians, period.
Yeah.
PAs and NPs are allowed to bill insurance for services via their NPI numbers.
Yep. Better.
Okay.
And delete the last
sentence. That sounds much better.
And so that's the last bullet on page 3.
Yep.
That's how that will read.
Thank you.
No, thanks for letting me.
Can't get my head together this morning.
And then we also had
And then the bullet
the
above
one.
That we're adding where it says NPs, we're inserting and PAs,
mm-hmm.
comma, particularly those specializing.
Okay. Does that sound good, Corley? I mean,
yes.
That's a little bit.
100%. Thank you.
Okay, perfect. Okay. John, either you have edits or things that you felt you wanted to interject?
Don't have it this time. And I'm not going to have it in the future either. It's okay. I'm not trying to prolong this.
That was a select legislative statement.
I thought I'd clarify that just in case. No.
You're good at your job. Very good. Robin, did you have any other things that you wanted to interject at this point?
I'm good.
Okay.
Okay.
What we ought to do is probably walk through all of the changes.
Exactly, page by page.
And then what we'll go with when we go into our work session will be the edited version. So we're going to kind of walk through the changes by page. Make sure we have all the language appropriate. So, Sandy, do you want to do that?
I'll do my best. And I know you folks
starting on page
chime
two.
In. Starting on page two, well, the front cover page is okay with everybody?
Yeah.
All titles, all name spelling, good? Okay. And before we start, everybody okay with the appendices? Was there anything else you guys wanted to include as appendices? Because I have the A is the bill, the enrolled bill. B were the goals that we had identified. And then we had mentioned a report from the workforce committee. And rather than put in that 50-page report, I'm just putting in a C that's got a link to their page with the report. You guys okay with that?
Yep. Yep.
Great. All right. Okay, page two. Only change is at the bottom of page two, the very last sentence, where NPs are now, we're going to insert and PAs. Page three, going down to the last set of bullets. The second bullet, the sentence is going to read, cumulative years of trainings for NPs and PAs, comma, particularly those specializing in behavioral health, geriatrics, and pediatrics. Bullet three is going to read, both NPs and PAs carry individual licenses to practice, period. PAs work collaboratively with their supervising physicians. PAs and NPs are allowed to bill insurance for services via their NPI numbers, deleting the last sentence. Is that accurate for three, page
yes.
three? Okay.
Yep.
Page four. Second bullet where we have the titles MD-DO-PA, we're deleting RN and inserting NP. Down in the fourth bullet, the sentence is going to read, large debt burden for physicians, PAs, and NPs coming out of training, influencing their choices of residency programs for those specialties with higher income potential. Is that all?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, great. Nothing on page five. Nothing on page six.
You have my page five and six, so.
I'm sorry?
You have my page five and six.
Oh, I do.
It's right here.
Oh, we had other changes
yeah,
on five. I am so, because you didn't highlight them.
Right.
I am so
let's
sorry.
Add those
okay.
They were just more
they're more
typo
acronyms type of stuff.
Typo
so
stuff.
I'm sorry. I did miss, Janine gave me her page five. The first bullet at the top of the page, it says recommendation that the Healthcare Workforce Committee of the Health Policy Board. So we're gonna insert of the,
delete the comma.
Right there,
mm-hmm.
Delete the comma. Moving down to number one in the middle of the page, where I now have the acronym on number one, OHPB, we're gonna delete that. And after OHA, where it says and the, that's where we're putting in the Oregon Health Policy Boards. And that'll be possessive. Number five, investigate through the Healthcare Workforce Committee, and then again, delete the comma and put of the Health Policy Board, and those were it. Those were the three. So those were just kind of Scrivener proper identification. Thanks, Janine. Okay, now moving on.
Page
to
seven.
Page seven. And this I may not have altogether correct. Guys, the recommendations, number one, utilize the health fund, the Health Policy Board Sustainable Healthcare Expenditures Work Group, acronym SHU, to understand high cost drivers and cost trends, comma, working towards setting a target for total healthcare cost growth reduction, comma, cumulative for all payers across Oregon, semicolon.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Then we move down to number three. Instruct the Oregon Health Policy Board, modeling after the primary care multi-payer agreement process, to study a similar payment mechanism to care for patients established in a lowercase behavioral, lowercase health focused
focused primary care setting.
Got it. All right. So all, thank you. Primary care setting, comma, provided the experience in these models.
Yep.
Okay. And I believe, did you have something else?
No.
On yours, on page 7? Okay. I needed it.
Okay.
So.
So any,
Robin, everything okay?
Further edits?
I'm good.
All right, thank you.
Okay, as just written.
Yes, as modified.
As just modified. Very good. Well, there's no further discussion. What we'll do is, just process-wise, is we're going to gavel out of our work, out of our informational session, and into our work session. So at this point, I'm going to gavel out, close the work, the informational session. Open the work session of the Joint Interim Task Force on Primary and Mental Health Care Reimbursement for, and our plan at this point is to adopt the final report and its recommendations. I need a motion for that adoption.
So, Co-Chair Kincaid, I move that the final revised report of the Primary and Mental Health Care Reimbursement Task Force with a be adopted recommendation.
Member Grant has moved that the final report of the Primary and Mental Health Care Reimbursement Task Force, revised, be adopted. Or is there any discussion?
You need a second?
No.
Hearing no discussion.
Do you want to do a roll call, or do you just want to do a no? Seeing no objections.
Yeah, I think we'll just do. Seeing no objection, at this point, the motion passes, and the final report of the Primary and Mental Health Care Reimbursement Task Force is adopted. Okay, we're going to reopen our informational meeting at this point, and so I appreciate you going through that exercise to do that adoption, and that the report will be forwarded to the appropriate Senate and House committees. So,
this is Lori Montana, and I just want to thank you for the wonderful work that you've been doing on this committee. I think that we have had some of the most dedicated people on some of the most complex issues. So I want you to go further in the committee, but I needed to thank everyone.
You're receiving a nod of appreciation. So thank you very much, Senator. We at this point, what we were hoping to do, we have roughly an hour, up to an hour, if we want to take that long, to discuss what's happening today. And again, as we go forward, what we want to do is make sure, as the session is in process now and bills are coming up, we want to have some opportunity to perhaps provide comment or suggestion in that process. So what we thought would be helpful, because there are a couple of bills and certainly some legislative concepts that are moving forward that directly address several of the issues that we have been trying to tackle and struggle with. So at this point, what we wanted to do is kind of just take a few minutes to walk through and just have an open discussion. Again, this is informational meeting and discussion related to what's in the docket, but not necessarily doing wordsmithing, editing, et cetera, but just expressing our opinions with respect to the legislative acts going forward. So Sandy was kind enough to push out, hopefully everybody received a series of attachments that included two bills and also I believe the legislative concept 2340. I think that she sent that out. And that is a concept that's being moved forward by the Oregon Academy of Family Practice. And so wanted to just put those out for discussion and comment. And I thought what would be helpful would be to start with the bills, being that the senator has graciously stepped forward, and we have Representative Parrish here in the room, as well as Representative Lively, all of which are named as sponsors for House Bill 2308. And so, as well as being involved in this process, hopefully would be able to comment on the intention of the bills and where they see that going, what the process is looking like, and the discussions thus far. So I'm not sure which one of you would like to comment, either, I don't know, Julie, John's pointing at Julie, or Senator Ho Sanderson's on the phone, so would one of you like to just sort of tee up where you think this is going, what the process will be, where you see challenges or not as the legislation moves forward?
Well, I'll take a swag at it, and you know, Jack Dempsey's here. He can certainly answer questions as well. I will put him on the spot. But I just see this as a cleanup bill to the original bill that brought us.
House Bill 2308.
Which is also Senate Bill 153.
Right, so which is, I believe, are they identical?
They're identical.
Yeah.
One is
inverse. Okay. One, the Senate Bill 153, they're identical except the House bill has an emergency clause and the Senate bill does not. Yeah.
So anyway, we just see this as a cleanup of the, you know, the problem that we identified around what the definition of independent practice is. So in terms of, you know, the process for it, depending on, you know, whether we choose as a body to work the House bill first or, you know, move the Senate bill, I think it's kind of irrelevant which one moves other than the emergency clause piece, which I'm six one way, half dozen the other on. We put an emergency clause on everything in this building. Everything we do is an emergency.
It's just standard print. You just kind of catch it on everything.
Well, you know, obviously, emergency clause speeds up the date of when, you know, effectiveness, and also makes it more difficult to undo. But anyway, Alex, for us, I think this is just a cleanup bill, and I think it'll move probably okay.
Yep.
And I believe that the OMA will also be addressing this in their legislative discussions later this month. So we'll see how they weigh in or not.
And this is Robin. I just wanted to add in, I looked at this bill and have no issues with it. I know that the Hospital Association folks are working on a bill pursuant to the acute mental health statute that, in the acute mental health statutes and how you work with patients in acute mental health settings, there's an inconsistency in language that sometimes allows for, it specifies physicians, and then other times has more generalized provider language. So we're going to have a bill that will clean that up and standardize it to license a dependent practitioner using the same definition that you're using there. basic consistency. I don't think that the bill 2308 gets to those specific issues in acute mental health, so we'll probably still need that separate bill, but it sure would be nice to find a way to draw that together and have that be standard through all our statutes. But I'm dreaming now, aren't I?
Robin, can I?
The remaining two clause is reimbursement of primary care services, so it is possible that they could all go together.
And that's the question I was going to ask. You know, Robin, do you know of somebody who is currently drafting what you just discussed, or should we, you know, check with LC to see if we can do an amendment to this? Our bill drafting deadline is today.
For new bills.
For new bills. Right. Otherwise, it'll be a matter of chasing down a legislator with a priority bill, and those are kind of like gold starting tomorrow. So, so I just want to make sure that if we need to address that, that, you know, we've got till 5 o'clock today to do that and have one of the four of us put something forward. And Sandy, I don't know what your thoughts are. It's just
Robin, did you say the Hospital Association, are they just in discussion or have they actually started, you know, doing some language development?
There's language development. I've got a meeting with Patty O'Sullivan at 10.
Will you have her circle around with me?
If I remember correctly, I think it's something that we're working with based on.
Okay. Say no more.
Well, this is Lori. I really feel that this, with the relating to clause, an amendment could be drafted for this bill also if we don't have one. So I wouldn't be too worried about getting another bill because an amendment could go into this one.
And Senator, I agree with you. I sent 2308 to Patty just a couple days ago, and I know we're going to talk about it this afternoon to see if we can't make that crosswalk work. Because it'll be much easier if it is also
primary care services. How does that?
Robin, do you know?
That will work with the hospital.
Do you know if there are other things that either the hospital or others have identified where there is that same, like you described, a language difference? As the provider models have changed and actually sort of new providers have come into the delivery system, are there other areas other than that acute psychiatric situation as well? Or is this something where we're going to have to kind of go through all the statutes to make sure the language is consistent? Or do you know?
The only ones we've been worried about have been really pursuant to all of the acute mental health, and we've done a pretty good, I think we're going to do our fifth or sixth read of all those acute mental health statutes.
Right now.
I haven't frankly gone out and looked anywhere else.
Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering if it exists there. I'm just thinking that it probably exists in other places, whether it's, you know, hospice care, other types of, you know, community-based care environments. I just was curious. So I'm sure those areas will be highlighted as people, you know, dive into the language and realize that there are inconsistencies. But as long as the inconsistencies exist, it does potentially create payment challenges. So I just want to make sure the language is consistent across through all the statute. So, okay. So basically, cleanup bill, you think this is going to move forward at least to make sure that that piece on the acute psychiatric is going to be added in?
Well, Robin, I'm sure Patty O'Sullivan will circle around with the chairs of the committee and brief them on it, and you know they may already have an LC that they're working off of, whether it's a placeholder. And quite honestly, we don't know how comprehensive that bill is really looking at compared to the straightforward 2308.
Our LIP stuff was pretty straightforward. We're just going after that one issue with that bill. There's a different one that's more comprehensive that would get it complicated. But we were just going after that one piece in terms of female health statutes. There are issues, for instance, sometimes it says if you're going to put someone in restraints, you need a physician license by the Oregon Medical Board. And then there are other places that are not that specific. And the inconsistencies cause great difficulties in terms of practice patterns.
Got it.
That was in the ER physicians yesterday and was talking about some of the issues related to placing holds. And RERWs, nurse practitioners. So it's always very frustrating for them to have to go and get another signature on an already complicated form. So that's kind of what we were going after.
I see. Okay.
Well, and I expect there's going to be other things that are going to come out as well. But okay, that sounds good. Any further discussion?
Somebody who can do a word search.
Yeah,
that would be an unforgiving task.
Well, a word search for what?
A word search to see all of the places in statute where this problem exists.
Oh well,
but
yeah.
That's what legislative council does. We don't need to worry about that.
Oh, wonderful.
So as they bring this up, then they'll go ahead and probably do that as well, I suspect, if it's the hospital association that's lined up to you.
Yeah.
Because they'll want to make sure they have all the people they need to do their work. Any other comments on 2308 or the Senate version, 153? The other, you guys did, hopefully everybody got a copy of the LC for the primary care medical home payment model process. And I think maybe
this is actually the policy board's legislative concept, which I think was dropped as a governor's bill.
Okay, I looked for a bill number.
There's a separate bill Senator Steiner Hayward is doing that's right. Been in discussions with the OAFP and PEDS Society, and I think just around New Year's they met with insurers. So they're, this particular one, it was to work to sort of basically require the payer plans to be part of a collaborative. They would develop up to 5 methodologies that a payer could use with the intent of not disrupting anything that's already happening, but trying to get all the payers to do something. And then kind of, it's called a pilot, I mean, to get it so that all those payers would then do something, one of those 5 methodologies, and then continue to evaluate that with the intention that, you know, that would carry forward. The collaborative would also include providers, and it is not just exclusive to the payers. So in essence, it's an approach that I think it's Vermont. We looked at all the states that had big multi-payer collaboratives and looked at their legislative language and how they did it. So it's really more like you're in this group, anyone who's in the group has to do something, and then we try to get that to be sort of become systemized and standardized, I mean, going forward without dictating to a particular plan exactly how they would pay. And so that's all this does. It doesn't dictate the amount or that any plan would have to pay. The Steiner Hayward bill, which I haven't seen the latest version of, is a bit more specific in that everyone would pay some amount based on your tier of a patient-centered homeness, and they have distinct dollar amounts in there. And I think there is some language around the collaborative discussions and stuff, but I haven't seen the latest version of that particular bill.
Yeah, I haven't seen it either. I know that the feedback in the initial was to try to remove the specific numbers.
Right.
Again, reflective of kind of earlier comments around having clear definition around the types of services necessary to meet the needs of each of those tiers. It may be different in different environments or different communities.
So the 5 payers that have worked on the Comprehensive Primary Care Home Initiative have sort of seen this concept, and with the idea that, you know, there are some payers out there that aren't doing anything and some are doing stuff. And so then the ones not doing it are kind of getting the benefits of those who are investing in these clinics. So it was a way to try to get that voluntary consensus around paying differently rather than just straight fee for service to patient-centered primary care homes that everyone signed a year ago
to have some, a little bit more teeth, but yet not tie anybody's hands on how, you know, if you want to do a capitation payment to the clinic, or if you want to just do a case management fee to the clinic, or come up with some other creative way to support those additional source of the, you know, the behavioralist in the primary care setting, or the primary care person in the behavioral health setting, that you would just, it would be a way for the clinics to sustain what they're working towards and changing the, to this new model of team-based care.
And I will speak as a provider. This is extremely challenging when we're dealing with so many different models, literally, and it's very hard to administrate. And what it does is it creates differences for different populations. So, which is really not how you want providers to, you know, walk into the exam room. You don't want their payments or motivations or whatever to be different depending on who they're seeing. So I think that the, from a provider standpoint, and I think that at least what's been conveyed at the Oregon Academy of Family Practice is that really want a standard structure or framework, which you could essentially negotiate with payers, understanding that everybody wants care coordination, everybody needs to have a primary care preventive services and acute services, as well as some sort of incentive around quality or outcomes that, you know, are really the product that you're trying to create. So I think that my sense at least is that everybody's begging for having a common structure. So at least what the delivery system needs to deliver looks the same for each payer. And right now it does not at all. So I think that there is, and I think that was part of our discussion earlier when we talked about the medical home and the structure of that, at least trying to put some understanding around what each patient in Oregon should receive as far as what primary care looks like. The other piece, though, that is really not called out necessarily in this, and maybe Robin knows more about that, is that whole behavioral health piece, trying to understand what that looks like. And the other thing about medical home, I think that's a challenge, is that medical homes need to be built around the needs of the patient. And a patient with significant psychiatric problems, mental health, substance abuse, et cetera, needs a different environment in order to receive their primary care than someone who doesn't have those issues. But the same thing exists really in other subpopulations. So almost the question of whether you have specialty medical homes. So if someone is chronic renal failure, their medical home is with their nephrologist. And everything revolves around that whole thing. And same thing with even cancer care to a certain degree. Once, you know, in those situations, their medical home is no longer really in what we would call a traditional primary care setting, but really revolves largely around that. So there are disease-based or population-based medical home environments that we can create that also have some similar
Well, the current standards don't preclude those from being, you know, that was part of the original design of the patients. The name patient-centered primary care home came from the legislature. The original name was more integrated health home. We had those discussions about an oncologist being the home for a cancer patient, the mental health clinic being the home for the schizophrenic patient. So that's why we went to outcomes and tried not to be so specific, was that they applied. And if you look at the standards, they could, a cardiology clinic for a particular patient might be able to qualify to be that home. But sometimes the national definition of medical home is much more limited than it is in the discussions in the Oregon definition of patient-centered primary care.
Which I think is very, you know, I think our the way we're approaching it is the way we're going to have to approach it. This is not a one-size-fits-all. It just is not. Mm-hmm. And even with respect to geography, you know, and the people you have actually doing the care, it's going to look different.
But I think what we were trying to do is kind of get everything under the umbrella of the PCPCH, because from a plan perspective, if they've mm-hmm. got to think, oh, I got to pay this different, an oncology home, health home or a cardiology health home versus a renal health home. I mean, it was just more like, can you all be a home? And all the payers could point to the same set of standards. So it was the discussions we had, which had payers around the table as well as the providers.
So is most of this that's come out, is it really a product of that multi-payer collaborative discussion? I mean, what's actually written is really what the product that came out of that, either in either of those pieces of legislation?
I think it's the experience of the multi-payer. They're worried about when Medicare pulls out of that, what's going to happen. Right now, we have another year and a half of Medicare being at the table with the three other commercial payers and Medicaid. It was pre-CCO, so there's a couple of former managed care Medicaid plans that are at the table and are for their subset of their CCO population part of that. So the concern is, what are we going to, you know, just much like when the federal health home dollars wrapped up, the 67 clinics are concerned about what happens to their infrastructure when payment, you know, there isn't a reason to be a multi-payer directive. And there seems to be folks like the way the CPCI multi-payer works. It's a little less onerous to the, I mean, they still have a lot of reporting and accountability. They have to report to both the feds and the payers. But versus the health home was very clumsy, difficult, to the way the CMS had it set up, where they were having to give lists of patients, and now it's a little bit more automated as to everybody, the payers kind of pay, and if a patient moves around, you don't have to go tracking it around. It's more kind of a lump pay sort of approach. So they've been very happy with the CPCI approach to date.
So looking at that type, where would you see these either bills merging or?
I don't know. I mean,
they're kind of addressing the same thing. It sounds
they
like.
Are. I think it's the. To me, it seems awkward to have prescriptive dollar amounts in statute, but just from my experiences with statutes, that sometimes then get difficult to change. So in 25 years from now, is $6 an appropriate amount or not? But I can understand the provider's perspective of wanting to have one type of payment coming in, but I understand the payer's perspective of not wanting to be told how to pay their provider network. And so I think it would be a interesting discussion of bringing the different sides together to come to what is the consensus to get something to happen, to move forward.
You know, one of the questions that I have about this LP, and I think it's very lovely, when you look at the section on page 2 where it talks about the collaborative shall include, and I know that there's heavy position, you know, there's heavy and there should be, heavy physician representation. I am concerned that we're, you know, if you look at the AHRQ documents and what's going on nationally, everybody talks about the fact that we need to reconnect the mind and the body, and we need to make sure that we're attending to behavioral health and primary care. We've all listed outcomes of attending to that, and while there are going to be specialty behavioral health homes for a small portion of the population, we know that 70 to 80% of people who are getting services for behavioral health receive those services in primary care. I would like to see that definition of the collaborative include a representative of a statewide professional association for behavioral health providers.
Oh, that's good.
You know, psychologists, LPSWs, LPCs, you know, I'm really agnostic on that. But I think the oversight of leaving that out, and I know that there's a line that says, you know, other people as needed, but we know 70 to 80% of the people receiving behavioral services receive them in primary care. Leaving that out of the definition of who should be in the collaborative, I think it's an oversight that we could fix and make a real statement about integration in a very different way.
No, that's a good catch, Robin.
That's great. Yeah, yeah. I kind of went skip right through that myself. I figured they would put all the appropriate people in there.
It doesn't specifically call out PAs or NPs, does it?
No, not at all.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it would be nice to see that in there.
Yeah.
Statewide associations for NPs and PAs.
And I'm sure there will be plenty.
I don't want to suggest that we're creating counts of thousands. It's just that role isn't covered in there. And yet that's where
not about anybody's specific license. Again, it's about that role for behavioral health, specific to integrated behavioral health.
Yeah, and I think a lot of this language was stolen from either Vermont or Maine or something, mm-hmm. so where they perhaps aren't as thoughtful as we are.
Thank you.
Haven't been sitting around doing pay parity work
that's
group
right,
for
that's right. In multiple arenas.
In multiple arenas.
And I completely agree. I don't like to put a dollar amount in a piece of statute because I think I agree that that's a dangerous slippery slope, that once we get ourselves stuck in there with $6 per member per month, I'd rather tie it to some other type of moving metric so we don't have to keep coming back to statute, mm-hmm. change the amount of money that's not going to work.
Janine, do you know if this is a House bill or a Senate bill?
I don't, actually.
I did a search on it yesterday, and nothing, the relating to clause didn't come up or anything, so.
And I'm not sure, there was a little delay in, because we had to get around the holidays to get a quorum of the policy board, officially bless it until January, so. So it may be why it hasn't been somewhere.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks. No, I can.
But Courtney could tell you, Courtney Wessling, government affairs person could. Your best friend.
She and I are BFFs. And she's not going to be here the whole time. I've already.
No, darn, have
I know,
baby.
I've scolded her. I go, you at least should stick around for the first chamber deadline.
I think one of the other things that is, kind of not here that I think it's going to ultimately make a lot of difference is really beginning to pay for outcomes in some fashion. So, again, this is really focused on making sure there's enough dollars up front to have the providers, but ultimately, really, what are the outcomes we're trying to achieve? And so where are, should a portion of payment be related to quality? Should a portion of payment be related to other types of...
I'll take that back. This is the one. This is Steiner Hayward's. Because it does have the $6, $8. I thought there was another one that had...
This is
Steiner Hayward's. I'm sorry, this is not the policy. I didn't turn the right page.
Because
it does have $6,
from,
$8, $12.
As you can see, November. So it's gone through several iterations. My understanding is that the specific dollars, that piece has been removed, but the concept of the tiered payment is still in there, at least that's my understanding. Now, how this is going to be brought out, I don't know the specifics.
Well,
so.
If it's her bill, then it'll be a Senate bill. She'll probably do it as a chief sponsor, so it'll be a Senate bill. Yeah.
So they must have incorporated some of our language from ours. That's why I was confused.
Right. And there'll probably be a discussion about which one is going to be the focus point instead of both of them. So, but like you said, you get the concept that's going to be floating around during session,
right.
The collaborative and the tiered payment.
I mean, do you get a sense that the governor is?
I think that our bill has some about. I was just thinking about the metrics, and that's why I was looking. And I think our version had some evaluation and set some. Specific measures to assess, because it talks about this sort of let's try this and see what happens, and then report back to the collaborative how it's working to make it more institutionalized going forward. So I think you'll see in our language something around those things you just brought up, Rick.
Well, I think that at least one of the most powerful things in my experience so far in the CCO work has been the influence of really paying for outcomes, and that actually does change the way care process and care delivery occurs. Certainly has accelerated the work that most primary care medical homes knew they needed to do, but were not yet fully operationalizing.
Although, there is always the challenges of the clinics being required to do things for meaningful use for their own CCOs, for their various providers, other health plans. So it's always challenging to, in order for the CCOs to get their incentive payments on developmental screenings, they might hold the PEDS practices accountable to report on developmental screenings. So there is sort of overlay there.
But I think it's the same challenge we talked about. You know, everybody's having to play with different rules, depending on, you know, where the patient happens to land with respect to either their payer or their particular, you know, population. And I think that's where we really ultimately need to try to bring that together, because the challenge with all of these different metrics is that they are different for different payers. And so that's really hard to manage on the ground. And so even if we could get to a common set of metrics, a common set of this is the baseline, that would be just huge. Because right now, even some of the measures for the same thing are different. Their baselines or their outcomes are different. So, and how they're measured are different. So that makes it really hard as a provider to try to chase these down based on insurer. But the government is... particularly the federal government is really hard to, you know.
We have no control.
That's right, no.
So I'm hearing that the governor's got a, has anybody looked at Senate Bill 231?
Tell us about that.
All I know is that it is.
It is what?
One second.
I'm pulling it up.
Oh.
Trying to pull it up.
Representative?
There we go.
Can you pull up Senate Bill 231?
Sure.
231. Just Senate Bill 231. I mean, I could do it on my phone, but it's not going to be very good. I know.
There we go.
And when you enlarge it, you get two words.
It's the multi-payer bill. That's the governor's multi-payer bill.
Oh.
See? Oh, okay.
That's it.
Relating to paying for primary care and declaring an emergency.
And
yeah, so that's the one I thought this was. Sorry, Robin, but that's what the policy board did. So that was Senate Bill 231.
Yeah, one. Great.
231.
So that's good. At least we got a number attached to that now. And I'm assuming that as... this other draft comes out, we'll, you know, attach a number to that one too as that, and then, you know, perhaps the process is going to merge or combine, or maybe most of the governor's bill's got the elements that are necessary, and but clearly the provider groups are struggling to try to pay for the services that are necessary to actually deliver the care, but also to have all these different definitions has been really challenging. So all of those are helpful. Are there any other pieces of legislation, Robin, that you're aware of on the behavioral health side that this group, you know, at least should kind of be aware of as we go through the next few weeks, so that we're kind of keeping tabs on those as well?
I've been working on, I think I said this earlier, working on some standardizing a definition for integrated behavioral health in primary care, based on the ARC definition and how we utilize that. And that's still with, the initial draft came out, and that's still with Lori Freeman. I was going to try and circle with her today to finish up some last edits on that. And then expanding to that is to try and open up some of the pieces of code that prevent us from using what I call right code, right place, right time. We have patients who present in a variety of different places, and we can't provide the services that they need due to code restrictions. So if you have somebody who shows up, and you've heard me tell the story many times, somebody who shows up in a pediatrician's clinic and we know that they need an evaluation for ADHD, and that's going to require a set of mental health codes, but unless that CTO has authorized that pediatrician's clinic to use those types of codes, you can't. Same idea for any willing provider. On the physical side of the Medicaid plan, it's very easy for physician and nurse practitioners and PAs and other types of providers to say, I'm going to take Medicaid and you get credentialed, et cetera, et cetera. On the behavioral health side, there are a lot of barriers to that. So any licensed provider can't necessarily take Medicaid. So the integrated behavioral health folks who've been working on trying to standardize some of that language are also looking to remove those barriers to make care more equitable, so we don't have the delays in care.
one of the biggest problems we've got is access, and we're working on an assessment here in Central Oregon, and here was the starkest statistic of the day yesterday. We have 55,000 Medicaid lives in Central Oregon, and while for everybody else, we have enough psychiatry for 1 to 10,000, but in the Oregon Health Plan, we only have enough psychiatry and psychiatry and nurse practitioners. We don't have any PAs doing psych in Central Oregon at this point, but we only have enough providers, prescribers, 2.3 serving 55,000 people. So those are the types of things that I know we've been working on.
Okay, so you expect legislation to come out to address some of those things during the session? And I'm sorry, who did you say was going to sponsor that?
Or do you know? It's a multi-sponsor at this point.
Okay.
I've been working very closely with our dear friend, Senator Monica Anderson, on getting that all put together and lining things up. So I'm very grateful for that.
Okay, great. And Julie, you said that the deadline is today?
Okay. 5 o'clock.
So obviously frantic work going on. Other potential legislative actions that folks are aware of related to behavioral health or primary care?
Well, this is very much in its infancy. This is Lori. You know, after reading the AMH report on mental health and listening so much on the end of mental health, there are a few of us legislators that feel strongly that that's addressing about 20% of the population, and mental health really is 80% of the population that we are not addressing very well. So we wanted to modernize mental health in the state of Oregon, and so it will probably be a task force or something huge, that, like we did with the modernization of public health this last interim. So that's probably coming out, because if we're putting so much money into mental health and we're working in a system where evidence-based, everyone's so different in every county, we just have to address that. But that is a real, you know, high-level idea that some of us are kicking around, and we have to submit something by the end of today, which I think we will.
And that's going to be focused on mental health, or will also include substance abuse? Do you know?
It's in its infancy. Right now, I want to sort of concentrate on mental health, because if we get addictions in there,
it's complicated. Yeah.
Yeah.
It will really get complicated. We need to maybe have another task force on that, but there's so many changes that we need to be doing in Oregon that, you know, we've got to see where the passion is in some of the legislators, I guess.
Do you think there is any hope of addressing the 7-Eleven drugs and at least folding them into some ability to manage that at least at the CCO level? Do you know if there's going to be any chance of that, or are the oppositional powers too strong to make that happen? Do you know anything? Do you have any feeling about that?
No, no one has really talked to me about that. I'm always willing to introduce ideas, because you on the ground level know a whole lot more of what you would like to see changed, and I rely on that kind of input. I'm trying to think which legislator has really had a passion about that. There is a bill on the 7-Eleven drugs, and we were actually supposed to have a meeting with Senator Hayward's office about that on Wednesday, and that got delayed, and that's now you've reached the extent of my knowledge.
Okay. It's just as a that's just been really challenging at the CCO level, to not have any ability to manage that part of the pharmaceutical expense.
Yeah.
for the patient your population you're responsible for, and we've just seen so much variation in utilization that I think there's a lot of opportunity to do that much better.
There has been attempts.
Completely agreed, and there is a bill. I just don't have a number for you at this point.
I think there was always attempts to do that in the past because the fully capitated plans, but now especially as you bring all those funding streams into one. One group or one community to look at it, the challenges have been stakeholders who are concerned about what that means for individuals. So,
yeah, I think, and that's the question: is, you know, can you create a system that, you know, protects the patient, but also challenges is dealing with, you know, to be honest, pharma. So it's you know, because they stand to gain quite a bit by keeping the current exclusion in place. So makes it very hard. So any other, yeah?
Any other? A number here, is that I think that's LC-2421. I haven't seen it for a while. It's not only pharma, I think there are NAMI has some concerns as well.
Yeah.
Just in terms of the variability across CCOs, what happens a lot, oh, House Bill 2421, sorry about that. The variability across CCOs, trying to find some standardized ways so that when people, because a lot of folks do switch CCOs, especially in areas where there is more than one, trying to find ways to standardize practices so that folks don't transfer from one CCO to another and then end up with a different type of formulary management system that may knock them off. So making sure that the grandfathering is correct, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I think everybody recognizes something needs to happen, but it's not just pharma that has a dog in that hunt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I think they're coming at it from a different direction. So, yeah, but you know, I think that NAMI's got some good, I think some legitimate concerns. So, you know, how do we make sure we put systems in place to address those?
I think NAMI's got some ideas about how to do that.
Great. Well, I'm sure that will be part of the discussion in that legislation. So hopefully we'll see how that goes. That's always, I think, a challenging environment to have to try to pull something out. Any other pieces of legislation that people are aware of at this point that they want to bring out? Okay. Again, thank you. It's helpful as we start to move into the process, and certainly after today, we'll have a much better idea of really what's in the sort of the hopper that really is going to affect our primary care and behavioral health and mental health delivery in our state. So as that comes through, we'll certainly have more dialogue. Our next meeting is scheduled for March 20th, just prior to spring break, I believe. At that meeting, we'd agreed before to kind of do every other month. At that meeting, we will be hearing from the Department of Consumer and Business Services, our report on the compliance from insurers on the current on 2902, the actual implementation of that. So we'll be hearing that report, as well as at that point we will be farther down the path of sort of the legislative process in the session, and I think have a much better idea of how some of the issues that we've brought up are being addressed. And so I think that will be helpful. The other question will be over time, as we have actually suggested in the text of our report, is that there may need to be either a reconfiguration or a change in the way that the task force operates, or whether the task force needs to continue to operate, or we sort of hand our work into the next piece. Several of the pieces of legislation have groups which are convening to address some of these issues. So those will be some of the dialogue in the coming meetings. And so we'll be addressing that in March. We're currently going to plan for the same time frame. So from a planning standpoint,
I'm not sure
we'll
if I'm
going
to be
that.
Able to get any rooms here in the building. That's going to be peak point of session, and usually the hearing rooms get booked up. This is usually slotted for judish. Now, some meetings don't meet on Friday, Senate generally is not holding their committee meetings on Friday, but the House will. I don't know if we're going to be meeting in the building or out. And I don't know if it's going to be at the same time slot. So
fourth floor conference room in the House? I mean, we probably fit there.
We don't have recording equipment in there and public seating and things like that that we're bound by. So time and location is yet to be determined. I'll have to, confirm where we can do and different times.
Yeah, I think receiving that report from the Consumer Business Services, it's going to be a challenge. Maybe we could do that virtually. I mean, it's possible we could create a virtual venue, but I think that would be very challenging from a operational standpoint.
And like I said, the only thing's going to be is the recording equipment, so mm-hmm. physical location and public access. You know, we're bound by those requirements, so. Okay.
So you'll be working on
that. I will. And I'll go back and see what rooms are out there for the 20th and if there's time slots. But again, it might be this room, but it may be one of the other hearing rooms down on the first floor or whatever. And I'll highlight it for you guys. You're still looking at the 8 to 10, mm-hmm. if something's available?
If possible.
Okay. I have a meeting from 1 to 3, Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays, so. I have a pretty full schedule, so that should work for me.
And the other question I wanted to ask is whether or not we wanted to continue to sort of push out sort of legislation to the group as it sort of comes out, just for so you're aware of it. It'd be nice if we could kind of do that through the process as things come up, just sharing across the task force what's actually happening. I think that would be helpful, so we can kind of continue the dialogue in the process, at least keep some of the paper in front of us. Did you have any other housekeeping items?
No. Nope.
Okay. Any other business for the good of the order? Hearing none, we are adjourned. Thank you all very much for taking the morning. Thank you all very much for taking the morning.